High above him, in the open hatch, the girl brandished a thick buff envelope. "This contains a copy of that statement for transmission. It contains also a list of names. 129 names, all of them either imprisoned or placed under banning orders by this monstrous police regime. The names on this list are the true leaders of South Africa." She flung the envelope, and it landed at Peter's feet. "Our second demand is that every person on that list be placed aboard an aircraft provided by the South African government. Aboard the same aircraft, there will be 1 million gold Krugerrand coins, also provided by the same government. The aircraft will fly to a country chosen by the freed political leaders. The gold will be used by them to establish a government in exile, until such time as they return to this country as the true leaders of the people." Peter stooped and picked up the envelope. He was calculating swiftly. A single Krugerrand coin was worth $170 at the very least. The ransom demand was therefore worth $170 million. There was another calculation. 1 million Krugers will weigh well over 40 tons, he told the girl. How are they going to get all that onto one aircraft? The girl faltered. It was a little comfort to Peter to realize that they hadn't thought out everything perfectly. If they made one small mistake, then they were capable of making others. "The government will provide sufficient transport for all the gold and all the prisoners," the girl said sharply. The hesitation had been momentary only. "Is that all?" Peter asked. The sun was stinging his naked shoulders, and a cold drop of sweat tickled down his flank. He had never guessed it could be this bad. "The aircraft will depart before noon tomorrow, or the execution of hostages will begin then." Peter felt the crawl of horror. Execution. She was using the jargon of legality, and he realized at that moment that what she promised, she would deliver. "When those aircraft arrive at the destination chosen by the occupants, a prearranged code will be flashed to us, and all women and children aboard this aircraft will be immediately released." "And the men?" Peter asked. "On Monday the 6th, 3 days from now, a resolution is to be tabled before the General Assembly of the United Nations in New York. It will call for immediate, total, mandatory economic sanctions on South Africa, including withdrawal of all foreign capital, total oil and trade embargoes, severance of all transport and communications links, blockade of all ports and air borders by a UN peacekeeping force, pending free elections under universal suffrage, supervised by UN inspectors." Peter's mind was racing to keep ahead of the girl's demands. He knew of the UN motion, of course. It had been tabled by Sri Lanka and Tanzania. It would be vetoed in the Security Council. That was a certainty. But the girl's timing brought forward new and frightening considerations. The beast had changed shape again, and what he had heard sickened him. It surely couldn't be merely coincidence that the resolution was to be tabled within 3 days of this strike. The implications were too horrible to contemplate. The connivance, if not the direct involvement, of world leaders and governments in the strategy of terror. The girl spoke again deliberately. "If any member of the Security Council of the UN, America, Britain or France, uses the veto to block the resolution of this General Assembly, this aircraft and all aboard her will be destroyed by high explosive." Peter had lost the power of speech. He stood gaping up at the lovely blonde child, for child she seemed, so young and fresh. When he found voice again, it croaked hoarsely. "I don't believe you could have got high explosive aboard this aircraft to carry out that threat," he challenged her. The blonde girl said something to somebody who was out of sight, and then a few moments later she tossed a dark round object down to Peter. "Catch!" she shouted, and he was surprised by the weight of it in his hands. It took only a minute to recognize it. "Electronically fused," the girl laughed, "and we have so many I can afford to give you a sample." The pilot, Cyril Watkins, was trying to tell him something, touching his own chest. but Peter was occupied with the explosive in his hands. He knew that a single one of these would be fully capable of destroying the Boeing and all aboard her. What was Watkins trying to tell him? Touching his neck again. Peter transferred his attention to the girl's neck. She wore a small camera slung around her neck. Something connecting camera and grenade, perhaps. Is that what the pilot was trying to tell him? But now the girl was speaking again. Take that to your masters and let them tremble. The wrath of the masses is upon them. The revolution is here and now, she said, and the door of the hatchway was swung closed. He heard the lock fall into place. Peter turned and began the long walk back, carrying an envelope in one hand, a grenade in the other, and sick loathing in his guts. Colin Noble's rugged frame almost filled the hatchway of the Hawker, and for once his expression was deadly serious. No trace of laughter in his eyes or at the corners of the wide, friendly mouth. Dr. Parker is on the screen. He greeted Peter, who was still buttoning his overalls, as he hurried to the command plane. We copied every word, and he was hooked into the system. Christ, it's bad, Colin, Peter grunted. That was the good news, Colin told him. When you finished with Parker, I've got the bad news for you. Thanks, pal. Peter shouldered his way past him into the cabin and dropped into his leather command chair. On the screen, Kingston Parker was hunched over his desk, poring over the teleprinter sheet on which the entire conversation between Ingrid and Peter had been recorded. The cold, empty pipe gripped between his teeth. The broad brow creased with the weight of his responsibility as he studied the demands of the terrorist commando. The communications director's voice from off-screen alerted Parker. General Stride, sir. And Parker looked up at the camera. Peter, this is you and me alone. I've closed the circuit and we will restrict to single tape recording. I want your first reaction before we relay to Sir William and Constable. Sir William Davies was the British ambassador and Kelly Constable was the United States ambassador to Pretoria. I want your first reaction. We are in serious trouble, sir, Peter said, and the big head nodded. What is the militant capability? I'm having my explosives team take down the grenade, but I have no doubt that they have the physical capability to destroy 070 and all aboard. I reckon they have an overkill potential of at least 10. And the psychological capability? In my view, she is the child of Bakunin and Jean-Paul Sartre. Again, Parker nodded heavily, and Peter went on. The anarchist conception that destruction is the only truly creative act, that violence is man recreating himself. You know, Sartre said that when the revolutionary kills, a tyrant dies and a free man emerges. Will she go all the way? Parker insisted. Yes, sir, Peter answered without hesitation. If she's pressed, she'll go all the way. You know the reasoning. If destruction is beautiful, then self-destruction is immortality. In my view, she'll go all the way. Parker sighed and knocked the stem of his pipe against his big white teeth. Yes, it squares with what we've got on her. You've read her? Peter asked eagerly. We got a first-class voice print and the computer cross-matched with her facial structure print. Who is she? Peter cut in impatiently. He didn't have to be told that the sound intensifier and the Zoom video cameras had been feeding her voice and image into the intelligence computer even as she issued her demands. Her born name is Hilda Becker. She's the third-generation American of German extraction. Her father is a successful dentist, widowed in 1959. The girl is 31 years old. Peter had thought her younger. That fresh young skin had misled him. IQ, 138. University of Columbia, 1965 to 1968. Master's degree in modern political history. Member of SDS, that's Students for a Democratic Society. Yes, Peter was impatient, I know. Activist in Vietnam War protests. Worker for the draft evasion pipeline to Canada. One arrest for possession of marijuana, 1967. Not convicted. Implicated with weathermen, and one of the leaders of on-campus rioting in the spring of 1968. Arrested for bombing of Butler University and released. left America in 1970 for further study at Düsseldorf. Doctorate in Political Economics, 1972. Known association with Gudrun Enslin and Horst Mahler of the Baader-Meinhof. Went underground in 1976 after suspicion of implication in the abduction and murder of Heinrich Kohler, the West German industrialist. Her personal history was an almost classical development of the modern revolutionary, Peter reflected bitterly, a perfect picture of the beast. Believed to have received advanced training from the PFLP in Syria during 1976 and 1977. No recorded contact since then. She is a habitual user of cannabis-based drugs, reported voracious sexual activity with members of both sexes. Parker looked up. "That's all we have," he said. "Yes," Peter repeated softly. "She'll go all the way." "What is your further assessment?" "I believe that this is an operation organized at high level, possibly governmental." "Substantiate," Parker snapped. "The coordination with UNO proposals sponsored by the Unaligned Nations points that way." "All right, go on." "For the first time, we have a highly organized and heavily supported strike that is not seeking some obscure partisan object. We've got demands here about which 100 million Americans and 50 million Englishmen are going to say in unison, 'Hell, these aren't unreasonable.'" "Go on," said Parker. "The militants have picked a soft target, which is the outcast pariah of Western civilization. That UN resolution is going to be passed 100-0. And those millions of Americans and Englishmen are going to have to ask themselves if they're going to sacrifice the lives of 400 of their most prominent citizens to support a government whose racial policies they abhor." "Yes?" Parker was leaning forward to stare into the screen. "Do you think they'll do a deal?" "The militants? They might." Peter paused a moment and then went on. "You know my view, sir. I oppose absolutely dealing with these people." "Even in these circumstances?" Parker demanded. "Especially now." "My views of the host country's politics are in accord with yours, Dr. Parker. This is the test. No matter how much we personally feel the demands are just, yet we must oppose to the death the manner in which they are presented. If these people win their objects, it's a victory for the gun, and we place all mankind in jeopardy." "What is your estimate for a successful counterstrike?" Parker demanded suddenly. And even though he had known the question must come, still Peter hesitated a long moment. "Half an hour ago, I would have put the odds at 10-1 in our favour, that I could pull off Condition Delta with only militant casualties. And now?" "Now I know that these are not fuddle-headed fanatics. They are probably as well-trained and equipped as we are, and they have had years to set this operation up." "And now?" Parker insisted. "We have a 4-1 in our favour of getting them out with a Delta strike, with, say, less than 10 casualties. What's the next best chance?" "I would say that there's no middle ground. If we failed, we would be into a situation with 100% casualties. We would lose the aircraft and all aboard, including all Thor personnel involved." "All right then, Peter." Parker leaned back in his chair, the gesture of dismissal. "I'm going to speak with the President and the Prime Minister. They are setting up the link now. Then I will brief the ambassadors and be back to you within the hour." His image flickered into darkness, and Peter realized that all his hatred was suppressed. He felt cold and functional as the surgeon's blade, ready to do the job for which he had trained so assiduously, and yet able to assess and evaluate the enemy and the odds against success. He pressed the call button. Colin had been waiting beyond the soundproof doors of the command cabin, and he came through immediately.